Hello and welcome to this episode of Databook. This is the second episode of our second season, and we are so glad to have you with us today. I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castle. Thanks for coming back for round two, everybody.
Just a little reminder, this season we are doing these episodes bi-weekly. That means every other week.
Yep, it's the second episode of the second season and we're doing them every 2 weeks.
So on this episode, we have a great guest. We have Marcy Darnovsky, who is the head of the Center for Genetics and Society. And she is here to discuss with us the complicated ethics of gene editing, which is kind of based off this story that our freelancer Jack Crosby recently published on the website.
Yep, you'll have to check that out. And while you're at it, please make sure to rate our podcast, subscribe to our podcast, and give us some reviews. Feedback is the breakfast of champions, people, and we're very hungry.
Yeah, we want to be champions. Mm-hmm. We also want you to tell your friends, because if you know about a good thing, it's the right thing to do for a pal.
We would have told all our friends already, but me and Jack are each other's only friends.
We're all we got.
Yep, that's it.
That's okay with me. Well, we actually also have our online friends, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Healthcare Analytics News. That is the magazine that we run and that we breathe life into every single day. And you should definitely check that out. So before we get to today's story, I want to talk about this movie that I once saw.
Odds are good that you guys have probably seen this one too.
So let's rewind the clock. I am 14 years old, probably got a lot of pimples, maybe wearing a punk rock band shirt, and I'm a high school freshman. And I was in this biology class with this really smart teacher named Mr. Soat.
Unfortunately, I was not in that class or in that school, although Jack, I would have loved to have met you earlier in my
life. That would have been good, maybe. Well, anyway, though, Mr. Soat, he's the kind of teacher who knows how to get kids interested in what he's teaching about. And sometimes that involves a little bit of help from the almighty television.
I could see it now, back in the day when they'd roll the squeaky wagon in with the TV. It was always a good day when you saw the big TV rolling in.
Always. So one day I walk into biology class and that's exactly what I see. Yes, TV. Mm-hmm. And we're learning about genetics and, you know, that can be kind of dry, especially if you're a 14-year-old kid. So Mr. Soat turns down the lights and he turns on this movie. It's called Gattaca. It stars Ethan Hawke and it came out in 1997 or something like that.
It's a story about this guy who lives in a society that is entirely ruled by genetics.
Exactly. Tom, you must have seen it too. Mm-hmm. So you can pretty much only become what the government allows you to become in this society. And that is entirely based on your genetic code.
Yeah, pretty spooky idea if you ask me. There are a lot of designer genetics going on in this movie. People who are programmed to be sports stars or geniuses or models, whatever, you name it.
And Ethan Hawke's character, well, he got a really bad deal. You see, he wasn't born into the whole program. And he's a custodian or something like that. And he's battling a lot of discrimination.
Yeah, he's got really lofty goals. He wants to be an astronaut, but he's stuck cleaning floors.
Until something happens. I'll just leave that to you to find out. Go watch the movie.
Don't want to ruin it for you.
The point is, this story really resonated with a young me. And probably not many things inside the classroom did resonate with me back then. But the idea that your genetics could define your place in life on such an oppressive, in-your-face level, that really hit me hard.
Gattaca is a science fiction movie, but the thing is, the technology underlying everything in the movie is not science fiction.
No, gene editing is very, very, very real, and it has a ton of promise for healthcare.
And everyone listening probably knows a little bit about this stuff, at least. We're talking CAR-T, CRISPR, TALEN, you know, the potential of gene editing.
But to know its potential problems, you don't even need to look to some dystopian vision of our future or even a movie like Gattaca.
No, you don't. To get a taste of the trouble that could lie ahead, all you need to do is look at our past. One of the biggest ethical problems surrounding gene editing is consent.
Now, this isn't for all forms of gene editing, but this one kind, germline editing, makes any changes to a genome inheritable. What that means is a parent can pass this change along to their children.
And of course, that's without any consent from the kid, without any say or any idea that this life-changing edit is coming down the pike.
Now, look, this is not a problem, again, with the gene editing therapies that are transforming medicine right now.
No, it's not. But the big idea here is still about consent.
Informed consent.
Because when issues like trust and patients' rights are on the table, there's a lot at stake.
And when healthcare and science don't act properly or transparently, they can actually doom cutting-edge advances.
And yeah, the truth here, Jack, is that we don't need to search hard for horror stories, for stories of reckless disregard for consent.
All we need to do is turn to a woman named Henrietta Lacks, whose cell line became one of the most significant in medical research. The woman whose cell line helped develop the polio vaccine and reach any number of insights into cancer, AIDS, anything.
Henrietta Lacks is the woman whose cell line was taken without her ever even finding out.
Henrietta Lacks was born in Roanoke, Virginia in 1920. A few years after her birth, her mother dies and her family hits a really hard time.
They didn't really have it easy to begin with. They were poor, they were African Americans.
So eventually Henrietta moves and lives in this log cabin that actually used to house slaves.
That's where she meets her future husband, David Day Lacks.
So time goes on and Henrietta is working as a tobacco farmer. You know, they're still poor. And when she's just 14 years old, she gives birth to her and David's first child, a son.
Now this is the first of five children that they'll have.
But most of these kids are born after Henrietta and David move their family to Maryland.
They end up settling in a black neighborhood in Baltimore County.
And that puts them pretty close to the prestigious Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Now, back in 1951, Henrietta starts dealing with vaginal bleeding, so she ends up going to Johns Hopkins.
And that, believe it or not, turns out to put her in a very disturbing situation.
When the gynecologist examines Henrietta, he finds a pretty big tumor. It's malignant and it's on her cervix.
Right away, they put her on what was then the best treatment pathway for this kind of disease.
Yeah, Henrietta receives radium treatments. They figure it'll kill the cancer cells and maybe she'll have a shot at going home to her kids.
At the same time, there's this guy who's collecting the cells of every patient with cervical cancer who walks through Johns Hopkins doors.
His name is Dr. George Gay. He researches cancer and viruses and he's got a big problem.
Every cell that he gets dies, and it happens quickly, and this really messes up any research that he's trying to undertake.
But somehow, out of the blue, this does not happen with Henrietta's cells. Instead, hers do the opposite. They multiply.
And that's probably because of the radiation.
Now, this is a big deal. All of a sudden, Dr. Gay has this cell line that seems invincible. So he gets to work and undertakes whatever research he pleases.
And he shares Henrietta's cells with other researchers. So these cells, they're called HeLa, they end up all over the place.
These cells are prolific. They aid research into cancer, AIDS, radiation, gene mapping, you name it. HeLa very well might have contributed.
Henrietta contributed. But the kicker is, she never actually knew of her contributions to modern medicine.
And that's because no one ever asked for her permission or her consent.
And no one ever told her.
So by early October 1951, just 7 months after stepping foot into Johns Hopkins, Henrietta died.
And eventually, more than 20 years later, HeLa cells make their way into other cell cultures. Why does this matter? They basically contaminate the other samples.
Yeah, so researchers start to call Henrietta's surviving family members asking for blood samples. They want to separate Henrietta's cells from the others.
They're trying to figure out what's going on, but her family's response is something like this. What are you talking about?
That's understandable. Somehow, in 1975, an unconnected conversation at a dinner party reveals why they're getting these strange calls. That is when Henrietta's family learns about her tremendous role in medical research.
So back in the early 1950s, researchers didn't ask for permission to take and study cell lines. It just wasn't what was done.
Even so, the case of Henrietta Lacks goes on to become a tremendously important story in medicine and science.
Because it shows just how vulnerable and valuable our most personal data can be.
And considering that Henrietta's DNA sequence got out into the public, it shows that our genetic data isn't just ours. It says a lot about our family members too.
But most of all, it shows the importance of consent. It shows just how critical trust and understanding are in medical research.
Because the Henrietta Lacks case and similar covert sort of research projects have fueled mistrust, particularly in Black communities.
And that skepticism of the medical establishment persists. It's why advocacy groups and experts are still going to communities to talk about their medicine and their research, and even to talk about gene editing.
It's a problem that could affect individual and population health.
It's a problem that is likely only going to grow stronger as science and medicine evolve. And it's a problem that seems to be unbreakable.
And that's because no matter how high-tech the treatment gets, they still all rely on trust and consent.
So to learn more about the ethics of gene editing, today on Databook, we welcome Marcy Darnovsky. Marcy is the head of the Center for Genetics and Society, and it really advocates for the responsible use of all of these new genetic technologies and data. It's a big advocate for patients and people. So Marcy, thank you so much for joining us on Databook today.
I'm delighted to be here.
First, I have a big question that might have a simple answer. Why should society care about the ethics behind gene editing?
Well, you know, gene editing is one of these really powerful technologies that potentially could really change things about our intimate lives, about our families, about our communities, and really about society as a whole, even the human species. So it's something that we should care about because it's going to affect us all. And I think a corollary of that is that it's something that we should all have a say in how it's used. We accept that we want to have some influence in a democratic society on things like tax policy or education policy or who sits in the mayor's office or who sits in the White House. But we've all lived through enough years to know that new powerful technologies can have as much effect on us as do those other kinds of policies.
What are the big issues at play here? You know, what should we be concerned about? What are you looking at?
The answer to that is really clear to me. The biggest risk is that we would use gene editing to engineer, try to design and predetermine the genes and thus the traits of our future children and future generations. And the reason I think that that's such a huge risk is that I think it could all too easily lead us into a society of genetic haves and have-nots, and that we would wind up layering new kinds of inequality and discrimination on top of the ones we already have, which we're trying to minimize. We don't want to go in a direction that exacerbates those injustices and makes them worse.
So one thing that our healthcare analytics news story about this issue kind of brought up into my mind is that through germline editing, we could essentially be enshrining our values, which are very time and place specific, to the rest of humanity. They can last and go on forever. So what do you think about that? What's the problem with that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, you can sort of imagine that you'd have fertility clinics offering these procedures, and you know, the ad copy kind of writes itself. You have to act now before you get pregnant. This really is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and of course you want the best for your child to be, but the best now is going to reflect the values that we have. And in this case, since it's going to be an expensive procedure, it will involve in vitro fertilization necessarily. It's going to be people of a certain socioeconomic strata who are going to use this, and they are going to have certain values. So what will it mean? Will it mean a certain kind of looks? Kids who are tall, maybe light skin. It's going to reflect the values that the people who use it have, and those are going to most likely be the dominant values in society. So we're going to be replicating a certain set of preferences that exists now, which has all kinds of problems associated with it. Not the least is, it may not be what the child is happy to have been created as.
Marcy, how do we tackle these issues? is the right path through discussion, education, community outreach, or is it regulation?
Well, I think it's through all of the above in general. And, you know, in fact, a lot of people don't realize that this question was being debated and discussed in a big way in the 1990s. Even before the human genome was mapped, it was clear that this was going to be a temptation and a very dangerous one. And there were debates that reached the level of legislatures in dozens of countries. And in every country that where it got to that point during that period, the conclusion was that genetic modification of future generations should be prohibited. So those laws are on the books in something like 40 countries. And there's an international, a binding international treaty from the Council of Europe that prohibits what's called germline modifications. There's a very widespread agreement already in effect about this. And it seems to me that we need to strengthen that, and that in a way that would be very helpful, because it would say, let's go forward with the uses of gene editing that are beneficial, and let's deal with the familiar social questions and ethical questions that arise about, is this gene therapy safe? Is it effective? And is it accessible to people rather than being so expensive that most people can't afford it?
What is the role of the healthcare provider in all of this? The people who are on the front lines?
That's a really good question and an important one. I mean, I think that healthcare providers are rightly, as professionals, focused on what they can do for the person that walks into their office or their examining room. And I think that's a very weighty responsibility. And I assume that almost all healthcare providers want to do the right thing. And that includes being really careful to recommend approaches to conditions that are going to help, that aren't going to harm, and using the best evidence available in order to make those recommendations. Well, we're very far away right now from the idea that any responsible professional could say, oh yeah, let's go out and, you know, gene edit an embryo that you produce to try to give you a better child. And I don't think anyone would do that. And I think that also, as we're thinking about the future and healthcare professionals in the future, it's really important that alternatives be explored. In the case of this idea that we're going to use gene editing in human reproduction, we already have alternatives that have been in use for a couple of decades that are much safer and that are much less socially fraught. They're not completely, you know, innocuous or innocent. But what I'm talking about is the embryo screening techniques that enable people who are at risk of passing on serious genetic diseases to avoid doing that and to have a child who is fully genetically related to both people in a heterosexual couple. So when we're thinking about using gene editing for reproduction, the medical argument that's often made for it, that it's going to prevent the births of children with Huntington's disease or other serious conditions, that's tenuous at best.
And what about fostering trust and education? As more gene editing therapies and other high-tech treatments come online, does the healthcare provider have a responsibility to foster these discussions and to make sure that the community is in the know?
Yes, I do think there are responsibilities. I mean, I think it's well-intentioned that a lot of people working on gene therapies are targeting sickle cell, a condition that affects many people of African-American descent who have not been well-served in the past too often by the medical establishment. But a couple of other things are also important. One is that we have to be really careful not to rebiologize race. And by that, I mean that I think we get in trouble if we think about race as a biological category rather than as a social and political category. And so while many people who have sickle cell anemia are of African American descent, there are others who are affected by sickle cell anemia who are not of African American descent. So I think that's one kind of issue to keep in mind, that in the effort to redress some of the past oversights and outright abuses, that we not perpetuate new ones. And then another one is just a question of priorities. Yes, we need treatments for sickle cell anemia. And if gene editing can provide those for people who are affected by sickle cell anemia, that would be a wonderful thing. But we also have to think about how we prioritize healthcare resources. And there are so many ways in which vulnerable communities are underserved that are not high tech, that are basic things that we know would help the thriving and the health of currently underserved vulnerable communities, that we shouldn't get carried away by the exciting, high-tech, sexy stuff.
So if you could change one thing about the gene editing ethics discussion that is or isn't happening right now, you know, whether it's a talk at the highest level or whatever, what would it be?
I don't think it's at a higher level. I think we have to like get the basic facts straight still. Most people haven't really wrapped their minds around this yet. So the basic fact that the medical argument for gene editing for human reproduction is so thin is not reflected in most media coverage. We actually did a preliminary study, and we found that in our sample of articles that were drawn from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, 85% of the articles that were in our sample didn't even mention the fact that there was an alternative, safer, less fraught way to prevent the transmission of serious genetic diseases. And I think if you don't know that basic fact, you can't really make an assessment of whether it would be a good idea or not to move forward with what too many people are now proposing. And I guess the other thing that I would say is that we need to think about the ethics that come into play in relationships between medical professionals and patients. But we also need to think about the broader social questions. So we have to hold both those things in front of our eyes, in the center of our view, if we're going to make a good decision here.
Marcy Darnovsky heads the Center for Genetics and Society. Some truly interesting work going on there. Definitely check it out. Marcy, thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me to be on DataBook.
All right, it's that time again. But before we say goodbye, we urge you to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on Apple iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts.
We love making it, and we hope you love listening to it. And if you do, let us know. If you don't, let us know too.
Let us know on Twitter, maybe. I am at Jack Murtha.
Yep, and I am at Castles_Tom.
Well, you can also check out our work and the work of our colleagues and dear friends on hcanews.com, because again, DataBook is a healthcare analytics news podcast.
Yes, feel free to join us in the production of this awesome podcast and this awesome website. We're always looking for new ideas. If you want to slap us with one, go for it. We'll turn the other cheek.
Hey, if you have a good podcast idea, I'm all ears, because a lot of the ideas I get are not that good.
They're my ideas. He's talking about my ideas.
Really, though, let's see what you got. If you got a story for us that we should be telling, send it our way.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we'll pick it up and maybe even invite you on to join us.
Why not? There you go. I think that's a makeshift competition that we just started here.
We love having you join us on these podcasts. It's an open door policy, and we get a lot of these stories from the community. If you're a member of the community, let us know and let's get the conversation going.
Send up some smoke signals. And until then, we will see you 2 weeks from today.
Yep. Enjoy the stories, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon.
I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
Bye.
See ya.